Now that you're back from the break, it's time to finish 1 Samuel. I know you thought that would never happen, but we have arrived at 1 Samuel chapter 31. This is a chapter which I have simply entitled, The End of a Man Without God. This is a chapter which focuses again on Saul. This is the chapter in which Saul takes his own life. It's interesting to hear what commentators will say about Saul in this particular event in his life. Some will say that Saul here proves himself to be courageous and heroic, because when he knew that he could do nothing to save his life, he had the courage to take his life. Now that is great thinking for Greek tragedy, but it's not biblical thinking. And so I don't think we want to import that kind of mindset to our assessment of Saul's taking his own life in this chapter. Notice in verse 4, Saul says to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and run me through, or these uncircumcised fellows will come and ruin me, and run me through and abuse me." Now, it's an interesting turn of phrase that he uses here. It's one that's used several times in the book of Samuel, these uncircumcised fellows. That was a way of referring to a non-Israelite pagan, okay? One of the Canaanites, a non-Israelite in this instance. It was the Philistines. Now, where this phrase occurs elsewhere, however, is instructive. If you look back to 1 Samuel chapter 14, verse 6, this is the first time it's used. 1 Samuel 14, and of course, you have an exact and clear knowledge of what is happening in every chapter in 1 Samuel, because you know someday there will be a testing of that. Of course, we've already covered 14, so it'll be the later stuff. But in chapter 14, Jonathan says to his armor bearer in verse 1, "Come, let us go over to the Philistine outpost on the other side." But he did not tell his father. And then we get the little digression telling us where Saul is and so forth. And then in verse 6, Jonathan says to his young armor bearer, sort of bringing us back to where we left off, "Come, let's go over to the outpost of those uncircumcised fellows. Perhaps the Lord will act in our behalf. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few." And you see that in the mouth of Jonathan, the uncircumcised fellows are not to be feared, because Jonathan has confidence that God is not limited to save, whether by many or by few. Then again, and in a similar way, in the mouth of David in chapter 17, verse 26, David asked the men standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And again in verse 36, "Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, because he has defied the armies of the living God." So in the mouth of Jonathan and of David, the term is a term of disparagement, a term of disdain, because of their confidence in God. Who is this guy? Who is this Canaanite, this non-Israelite, this unbeliever, these uncircumcised fellows? But to Saul, they are a threat. To Saul, they are individuals, entities to be feared. And so he says, "Draw your sword and run me through, or these uncircumcised fellows will come and run me through and abuse me." John Bright says that Saul was never lacking in courage. I would suggest that he was often lacking in courage, not only here, but back in chapter 17 when faced by that Philistine giant. Remember, the Israelite giant was cringing and trembling and drawing back in fear, like all the rest of the Israelites, until David arrived. Now, I saw a couple of hands go up. William? Okay. If I can repeat that briefly, the comment is, in the mouth of David and Jonathan, they recognized that being uncircumcised fellows outside the covenant of the Lord was your comment, that David and Jonathan really had nothing to fear because God was with him. Right. Okay. Right. Scrupulousness, yeah. Right. Recognizing that this is a kind of a cipher for those who are outside the covenant of the Lord. To David and Jonathan, they looked at it from the perspective of God would give victory over these individuals, whereas Saul may have been looking at it as, well, these are going to be then scrupulous or unscrupulous enemies. They may do whatever because they are not within the covenant. They are not under the covenant of the Lord. You might push that a little bit farther and say that perhaps there was a sense that Saul himself had that he too was outside the covenant of the Lord. I think that would tend to confirm what we've been saying all along, that really Saul didn't know the Lord, was not in touch with him, and had not been answered even when he had gone looking. He was outside the covenant himself, so he was, in a sense, on equal footing and overmatched. And so thus he feared them as well. Yes, Beth? Right, okay. Right, which we need to do fairly shortly. Yes, the question is, what about the account in 2 Samuel chapter 1 of the Amalekite who claims to have killed Saul? Certainly the Amalekite would have been one of those uncircumcised fellows. Not a Philistine, but nevertheless someone outside the covenant. And he does claim to have taken Saul's life. Well, we'll get to there to that in just a second. Just a second. The other question I think we need to ask ourselves as we look at Saul's self-inflicted death, his suicide, and maybe again this is the stuff of another course and I shouldn't get into it, but sometimes I have actually heard people say that a Christian would never commit suicide. What do you think of that? It certainly happened. I think it has happened. What is the unpardonable sin? Ooh, there are a bunch of unpardonable sins. Oh, dear. Yeah. Well, blasphemy against the Holy Spirit in the sense of rejecting the overtures of God and His claims upon our life and just obstinately turning a deaf ear to those throughout our lifetime, that is the unpardonable sin, I think, in general terms. Taking one's life is certainly not something that one would aspire to or something that would be approved or something that would be necessarily good, but I see it as no different from any other sin that we sometimes in our weakness and in our infirmity and sometimes on our medication could sink to. And so I would want to argue strongly that it is possible, though not advisable and certainly not commendable, that a real Christian could sink so low in depression that he or she might take his or her own life. And I would never want to stand up and say, well, Christians could never do that, and to do that is to prove you're not a Christian. God, we know that God is sufficient for all our needs. In fact, we are not slaves to sin, and in that regard, there's no excuse ever for sinning. You know, we're not slaves to sin. We always have the power of the Holy Spirit. There's never an excusable sin, and certainly taking one's own life is not an excusable sin. And yet, because we're not glorified yet, we're not in the fully sanctified, glorified state, we do sin in various ways, and I think that could be one sin that a Christian could commit in the extremity of depression or whatever. Yes, John. There's a time when taking your own life is permissible. Yeah. Sure. Oh yeah. If you're a soldier, if you're laying down your life for someone else, all kinds of instances where it would be not only permissible but commendable to lay down one's life. Yes, Sandra. Yeah, the question has to do with Jesus saying to the 12 disciples, you 12 will be with me, and then the problem of Judas entering into that. You know, I would have to see the exact reference and the exact passage. I don't recall where he exactly says that. He talks about 12 thrones and so forth, but I don't know that he ever addresses those 12 and says, you 12 will be with me. Maybe we better leave that one aside until we get closer to the New Testament, and then we can deal with that one. Okay, before we move to 2 Samuel, are there any other questions or comments you particularly wanted to raise about 1 Samuel? And we can still discuss 1 and 2 together, but one more question here and then we'll move on to 2 Samuel or comment. Right. The question is the division between 1 and 2 Samuel an arbitrary division? Were they originally one work? And the answer to both of those questions is yes. Or at least, yes, they were originally one work. Whether the division is arbitrary or not, I'm not sure. It does make some sense. It comes at the end of Saul's life. But in 2 Samuel 1, to which we now come, David is lamenting the death of Saul and of Jonathan. And so there is this interconnection between the two books. And it does appear that originally they were written as one book. And the division of the two came rather later in the transmission of the text, maybe for simple pragmatic reasons as to how much a particular scroll or a particular codex could hold. Yes. This is a follow-up question, so he can still ask it. Yes. When you do a literary analysis, or when you're studying the two, do you look at them as one work? Yeah, I do. I would look at them as the one flowing into the other, while recognizing that there is, you know, a significant stopping point in the life of Saul in chapter 31. I would see them as interconnected. But again, that in a way is true of a canonical approach to the scripture in general, is to see the parts in the light of the larger whole. But here, you know, the division is maybe not even legitimately into two parts. Maybe we should think of this as one whole. Okay, shall we move on and talk about 2 Samuel? In 2 Samuel, the first five chapters, we have God's king on the throne. God's king reigns is the title I've given it. The enthronement of David over Judah first, and then of Israel. And in giving a title to these five chapters, I've simply said, in God's good time. In God's good time. David, although some accuse him of doing whatever is possible to get onto the throne of Israel and Judah, that is certainly not what the text tells us. He had opportunities to speed his way to the throne by killing Saul and did not do so. In fact, chapter 1 makes it very clear, unless you take a cynical approach and say that the narrator is meaning to dupe us, chapter 1 makes it very clear that David was innocent in Saul's death. And this is attested in several different ways. As was mentioned earlier, an Amalekite comes and claims to have polished Saul off. In fact, in verse 6, it goes this way. The Amalekite says, "I happened to be on Mount Gilboa," the young man said, "and there was Saul leaning on his spear with the chariots and riders almost upon him. When he turned around and saw me, he called out to me, and I said, 'What can I do?' He asked, 'Who are you?' 'An Amalekite,' I answered. Then he said to me, 'Stand over me and kill me. I am in the throes of death, and I am still alive.' So I stood over him and killed him, because I knew that after he had fallen, he could not survive. And I took the crown that was on his head and the band on his arm and have brought them here to my lord." Then David and all the men with him took hold of their clothes and tore them. They mourned and wept and fasted till evening for Saul and his son Jonathan and for the army of the Lord and the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. Now, what do we make of the Amalekites' claim? Do we necessarily take it at face value as what actually happened? Not necessarily. I think in those days there would have been great reward expected if you showed up with the insignia of royalty and say, "Hey, it's yours, and I'm the emissary. I brought it. In fact, I polished the old guy off. Now, he asked me to, so I'm not really to be criminally liable for that." But it's quite possible that the Amalekites simply discovered the body of Saul on Mount Gilboa, got there first, and thus robbed him of his insignia and such, and brought it to David, and cooked up this story in the hopes of receiving a reward. What did he receive instead? His death sentence. Sort of David condemned him by his own words, by his claim. He didn't really contest it. He didn't really say, "Oh, did you really?" He just said, "Well, okay, if that's it, then you will pay with your life." And David had him executed. David was not anxious to have Saul eliminated. Now, I think he was under pressure from Saul, and I think perhaps in the same way that he saw God deal with Nabal, he was seeing God deal with Saul here. But David himself was not complicitous in this affair, if we take the text at face value, which I think we should. Now, many commentators don't, and you need to be aware of that, but I think we should. Now, we get then in the end of chapter 1, we get into the Song of David, the lament of David over Saul and Jonathan. And this is remarkable in its graciousness. Often we see this at funerals, that people who perhaps were at great odds with an individual in life tend only at the time of the funeral to remember those good things that can be said and say those. That is certainly what I think David is doing here. He was not unaware of what Saul had attempted to do to him. But by putting Saul and Jonathan together, of course, then David was dealing with mixed feelings, because Jonathan was someone whom he loved very deeply and who had been very, very committed to him. Let me guard you against one other misinterpretation. Verse 26 is sometimes cited as an indication that David was homosexual, because he says, "I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You are very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of women." Now, you know, love is an ambiguous term, and you can try to read it in a homosexual sense, but to do so would to fly in the face of all that the Bible teaches elsewhere about this particular orientation. And I think probably what David is simply saying is, David, your love, in the sense of your commitment and self-giving quality to me, the way in which you stood by me, the way in which you were willing to give of yourself for my betterment, the way in which you were willing to defer to me, is something that I haven't even experienced from my wives. He hadn't experienced it from Michal, who was Jonathan's brother. And so I think he's extolling not the love of friendship as in some way superior to marital love, but he's saying, in my case, what I experienced from Jonathan was true agape love, self-giving love. And to read this in the sense of some kind of evidence of homosexuality on David and then, of course, Jonathan's part, I think is going way beyond what the text would warrant. And so be aware of that. You will hear probably more and more of it as people search the Scriptures seeking to find ways of justifying a particular behavior and lifestyle, which I think is, and if we're clear-eyed and honest with ourselves, is not approved, is regarded as a sin, not a sin that is the unpardonable sin, not a sin that is worse than other sins. Any sin is sufficient to send us to hell apart from the grace of Christ, but nevertheless a sin and not something to be rationalized. Yes, Tommy? Or it says, actually, the question has to do with David's experience with his wives and with Michal and what he had experienced there. And the question is, didn't it say that David loved Michal? I think it actually says that Michal loved David. And when Saul discovered that, he thought, aha, here's a second chance to get it at David, you know, and perhaps bring about his downfall. Maybe Saul knew Michal too well. I don't know. But it is true that when David was forced to flee, Saul gave Michal to another man, you know. Now, again, Michal is not necessarily thereby indicted. She was under her father's authority, I suppose, in that case. And we don't know what recourse she would have had. So we don't want to be overly critical of Michal. But I do think we can say Jonathan's commitment to David and the way he treated him and the self-giving way that he deferred when he was crown prince and he recognized that David was God's choice, and he willingly gave way to David and sort of paved the way for David to become king, is an astonishing example of what real love is. Wishing the good of the other person and considering the other person's interests as important and even more important than your own. And I think that's all he's talking about. And I think to read it otherwise is to go too far. One thing that a recent book that I read and reviewed by feminist writers drew attention to what Saul one time said to Jonathan about his being the son of a perverse woman. What was that? Where was that? Back in 1 Samuel 19, he calls him a name. 20, yeah, 20. See, I haven't memorized this yet for the test. But what verse is it? Verse 30. Thank you. I'm glad someone has memorized it. Maybe they were just attracted to that particular turn of phrase there. But Saul's anger flared up against Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman, don't I know that you have sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of the mother who bore you?" These writers that I read recently were trying to argue that by indicting Jonathan's mother, Saul was saying, there's something wrong with you, there's something wrong with your sexuality and your gender and your orientation and all that. But I think that's what I would call reading in or eisegesis. I think it's more of just an expression that Saul was using at that point. Shall we let that one go, that hot topic? We'll leave that for ethics class. Let's move on to chapters 2 and 3. In chapter 1, which we just finished, we see that David appears to be innocent of Saul's death, and I think that's an appearance that we should believe. In chapters 2 and 3, we go on to read about the war that continued between the house of David and the house of Saul. With the death of Saul, the supporters of Saul did not immediately realign or disband. There were those who continued to be Saulides, and so that war continued for a while, or at least the animosity. It's actually described as a war in chapter 3, verse 1. The war between the house of Saul and the house of David lasted a long time. But notice the end of verse 1, David grew stronger and stronger while the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. Another reflection that God is blessing the house of David and bringing David into prominence. Now, we also learn in chapter 3 that David was innocent in the death of Abner. Remember, Abner had been Saul's general. And Abner does eventually die. He is killed. And it's important that it be clear that David was not the one who brought this about. And in fact, chapter 3 sort of belabors the point. Look at chapter 3, verse 21, for instance. In verse 21, Abner said to David, I'm not rehearsing the whole account here. Abner has come over to David because of falling out with Ishbosheth, which was the sole surviving son, or who was the sole surviving son of Saul. And he's come over to David and made an overture of friendship and has offered to bring Israel over under David's authority. And then Abner said to David, "Let me go at once and assemble all Israel for my lord the king, so that they may make a compact with you, and that you may rule over all that your heart desires." So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. Now, he went in peace, and then that's repeated in verse 22. Just then David's men and Joab returned from a raid and brought with them a great deal of plunder, but Abner was no longer with David in Hebron because David had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. When Joab and all the soldiers with him arrived, he was told that Abner, son of Ner, had come to the king, and that the king had sent him away, and that he had gone in peace. And in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, we read this again in verse 24. So we don't know for sure that it's original and has been left out, or whether it has been inserted, really, or augmented in the Greek translation, but Joab went to the king and said to him, "What have you done? Look, Abner came to you. Why did you let him go? Now he is gone in peace." And so at least three times, possibly four times, it's clear that David let Abner go in peace. So the fact that Abner now is dead is someone else's fault. It is not David's. Now again, you know, cynical people could say, well, that's just the way the story's told to assure us that David is innocent. And in fact, because he doth protest so much, he must actually be guilty. Well, if we take that line when we're reading the biblical text, and we don't trust the inspired narrator to be leading us in the right pathway, even if at times very subtly, but if we don't trust him to be at least leading us in the right direction, then we're in big trouble, because we're going to be counter-reading and back-reading and reverse-reading everything we come upon. So take it as you will. I prefer to believe that this is true, that David allowed Abner to depart in peace. And as we're told, it was Joab who actually ended up taking his life through nefarious means. Again, when we come to chapter 4, same kind of point is made. In chapter 4, we have recorded the death of Ishbosheth, who was the sole surviving son of Saul, who was not killed on Mount Gilboa. And this has raised some discussion. Where was he? Was he a little weakling who was not fit to go into battle? We know that he was certainly of age, because I believe he was 40, I believe, when he became King Ishbosheth. So he was certainly of age and could have gone into battle. The text talks about the entire house of Saul dying with him on Mount Gilboa. Now again, be careful when you read about all of Saul's house. And when you hear the word "all" in the Bible, it doesn't necessarily mean every last living individual. Okay? It just means, for all intents and purposes, Saul's house was over and done with. There was no further hope, even if little Ishbosheth, or weakling Ishbosheth, or whoever he was, continued to live. So we need to be careful to read the Bible in its own terms, not impose an overly rigorous standard that would find it in conflict with itself. Well, Ishbosheth is still alive, but he does lose his life in chapter 4. Not at the hands of Joab this time, but at the hands of two other individuals who come then and report their proud deed to David, and he has them promptly executed. Again, demonstrating that David does not take delight in the death of his enemies, even if it opens the door to his throne to be established over Israel, the northern kingdom, what would eventually become the northern kingdom, as this chapter does. And so by chapter 5, David is finally, firmly established over Israel and Judah. And it's interesting to read in verse 12 how David understood his position. In verse 12 it says, "And David knew that the Lord had established him as king over Israel and had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel." That's a very good verse for any who ever find themselves in positions of leadership. There are two very good points there. First is, the Lord had established David as king. It wasn't that David had earned that right or was so clever or so good or had somehow qualified to be king. He had won the competition and thus he was on the throne. But rather, this was God's doing. And leaders, whether in corporations or in families or in churches or wherever in communities, leaders should recognize it is God who raises up leaders and brings them down. And so to find yourself, if you find yourself in a position of leadership, nothing to be proud of. It's God's doing. It's not yours. Nor is it something, a position to be exploited. Because notice, David understood that the Lord had exalted his kingdom, not for David's sake, but for the sake of his people, God's people, Israel. Again, a very salutary encouragement to leaders. God puts you there, and it's not to be self-serving. It's not for your sake. It's for the sake of those whom you are to serve in leadership. So David is off to a good start. He's arrived on the throne. It's God who has put him there. And at the end of this chapter, we read of David definitively defeating the Philistines. In verses 17 and following, we have the account. I'll not take time to read it all. But maybe the last verse. "So David did as the Lord commanded him, and he struck down the Philistines all the way from Gibeon to Gezer." A resounding victory over the Philistines, who have continued to plague Israel since the days of Saul. In fact, it's interesting to compare, to look back one more time to 1 Samuel 14 in the summary of Saul's reign. Right after that is complete, in 1 Samuel 14, verse 52, we read, "All the days of Saul there was bitter war with the Philistines, and whenever Saul saw a mighty or brave man, he took him into his service." All the days of Saul there was bitter war. Now God's king is on the throne, God's king reigns, and God's king begins to succeed. And he does so by defeating that arch enemy of Israel, whom Saul had been anointed to deal with. Remember in 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 16, that was to be Saul's assignment. Saul had failed, but God in his grace had raised up another leader who now has succeeded, and the people are delivered from the hand of the Philistines. Now, so God's king is on the throne. God's king reigns. In the next section, chapter 6 to 10, we have an account of David's reign, blessed by God. We have an account of how David obtained and occupied his capital city. We also have what I like to call the cardinal promise, the all-important Davidic promise, the dynastic promise that is given to David in chapter 7 of 2 Samuel. Now, as we look at these chapter by chapter, chapter 6 is a very interesting one. This is the chapter that recounts David bringing the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. And I've given two titles to this particular chapter. One is The Hazards of Success. David has been very successful to this point, and now he experienced some of the hazards of that success, which leads me to my second title, which is Well-Meaning Carelessness. Well-Meaning Carelessness, which is what, in fact, we find, I think, in this chapter. As we as we read about this bringing of the ark to Jerusalem, we read in verse 3 of chapter 6, they set the ark of God on a new cart and brought it from the house of Abinadab, who was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, sons of Abinadab, were guiding the new cart with the ark of God on it, and Ahio was walking in front of it. David and the whole house of Israel were celebrating with all their might before the Lord with songs and harps, lyres, tambourines, sistrums, and cymbals. When they came to the threshing floor of Nahon, which sounds a little bit like stability, which is real strange, Nahon, Uzzah reached out and took hold of the ark of God because the oxen stumbled. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore God struck him down, and he died there beside the ark of God. Then David was angry because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah. And to this day the place is called Perez Uzzah, which means outbreak against Uzzah in the Hebrew. Now, what is happening here? What went wrong in this? What is wrong with that picture? What went wrong in this particular instance? Yes, William. Okay, that wasn't the prescribed way to move the ark. What was the prescribed way to move the ark? Poles. Okay, poles, rings in the side. They're there for some reason. Put the poles in them. Have people carry the ark at the ends of poles. And unless all stumble at once, the ark is not going to fall. Far different from a cart tipping over. Maybe the Israelites got the idea of a cart from the Philistines who had last returned the ark to them. You know, that's how they had last seen it. Now, it wasn't the same ark because they destroyed that one and chopped up the wood and burned it in a sacrifice and such. But maybe that's the last way they'd seen it transported and thought, well, this is the modern age. Let's do it the modern way. Now, do you think for a moment that Uzzah and David were not... Well, maybe I should limit it to David because the NIV at least speaks of his irreverent act. I would want to check that a little more closely to see if the text is that clear that Uzzah was being irreverent. But do you think that David, for a moment, meant to be irreverent, was insincere in what he was doing? I don't think so. But I do think he was careless. You know, and there's a lesson to be learned there that sincerity is not the same as, you know, sincerity does not necessarily eliminate presumption on our part. Sometimes we can be sincerely wanting to do the right thing and wanting to obey God, but if we don't go to the trouble to see what God has told us should be the content of our obedience, you know, He's given us lots of instructions and lot of commands even, that we don't obey so as to merit His grace and merit His favor, but because He is our Father and out of gratitude, we should want to do what He tells us to do, and He's told us how to live. It's not good enough just to say, well, I sincerely want, and I have my heart is sincere toward God, if we neglect what He has specifically given us by way of real instruction. And so David, I think, was sincere. I mean, it appeared to be so. He was rejoicing and dancing, and they were all just having a wonderful time. And then this thing struck. And I think the point that needed to be made was, this is a holy God. When He gives an instruction, when He speaks, He is to be heard, and He is to be obeyed. Don't just think it doesn't matter. Don't just think, well, as long as my heart's right, no big deal. Now, that doesn't mean that God is a legalist who has no understanding for the exigencies of certain situations. One of the later kings of Israel wants to celebrate, I can't even remember what the feast is at this time, but he wants to celebrate a certain feast, but it's out of sync, it's out of time with the calendar. And yet he wants it to get reinstituted, and he prays to God and asks, could we do this as it were out of order? And God allows that. You know, so it's not like it's a legalistic thing. But that king was not being presumptuous. He was both sincere and not presumptuous. Whereas in this case, I think the celebrants were sincere, but were being presumptuous in their behavior by not really reading and listening and doing it the way God said. It's important that we know God's word and that we live by it. The hazards of success. Things were going so well, they just kind of forgot to consult and do it just right. Remember way back in Joshua, when God said, be strong and very courageous, do not let this book of the law depart from your mouth. You know, be strong and very courageous. That's where it's going to take the greatest courage, especially when you're on top. Be careful that you don't then think, well, now I can play a little fast and loose with God's instructions. So we need to hear them there as well. Yeah, William. Yeah, right. There are many, many, many open questions in terms of... The question is, how much scripture would David have had at his disposal? What would he have been able to read? What would he have known? There are many open questions and a great diversity of opinion as to when certain books were finalized, inscripturated, and so forth and so on. I will betray my conservatism here by simply saying that when we speak of the Pentateuch as the books of Moses, I take that seriously and would see Moses as the primary individual responsible for those books, the primary instrument by which we receive the first five books of the Bible. That does not mean that he anticipated and described in advance his death, for instance, which is recorded at the end of the book of Deuteronomy. It doesn't mean that everything in those books is necessarily from the pen of Moses or his scribe or whatever. But the bulk of that is from Moses, and thus it would have been existent, I think, in the time of David. I also think that the former prophets, which are these historical books that we're reading, this is an opinion, it's not something that I can prove, but I think that the prophets who were those who spoke God's word into their societies, you know, thus saith the Lord, were also those who commented on history and recorded God's perspective on the events of their day or of days shortly elapsed. And that became a building tradition, which then ultimately led to a finalized version of the history of Israel as we have it in what is now called the Deuteronomistic history. I better not get into the complexities of how rightly to view the Deuteronomistic history. But I would say that David would have had access to those instructions. He would have had those under his charge who could have alerted him to that and looked it up for him. The book of the law, I think, was still available. Not necessarily the book of the law that is discovered in the days of Josiah. You know, the book of Deuteronomy, which that seems to be, there are some unanswered questions as to when that book of the law may have been lost in Israel's history or gone missing and remained unconsulted. The other thing we need to bear in mind really about that kind of question, how much scripture would they have known, we need to be very careful not to assume modern standards of cross-referencing and direct allusion and footnoting and all of that, because if ancient texts don't explicitly mention other ancient texts, it's easy for us to assume they didn't know them or they would have mentioned them. They would have put that in a footnote, or at least there would have been a reading list at the end of the book, you know. That's the way we do academic work today. That's not the way they did it. And in fact, often their intertextual allusions are far more subtle and sophisticated than are ours, where we simply cite, here's the author, here's the date in which that was published, and here's the book, and you can look it up in books in print. So the fact that something is not explicitly mentioned does not by any means mean that it was unknown. And it's been curious in the history of scholarship that there have been various orderings of the material that we have in the Bible and when it must have come into play by virtue of a lack of mention of it. For instance, the prophets, the classical writing prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and such, do not constantly cite the book of Moses. And that led some early critics to assume that, well, since they don't cite it, the book of the law, the book of Moses, must not be from Moses, must have come much later. You know, and so the prophets came first and then the book of the law came later. Well, and then wisdom came later than that still, and you know, they got this relative order of the books. But since that time, continuing study has begun to find rather sophisticated allusions to legal material and the assumption of the legal material, even if it's not directly cited. So all of that stuff is up for grabs, which is a long answer to a very straightforward question. Sorry. Yes. Right. Why would the Lord's anger burn against Uzzah for improperly touching the ark, but not against David for improperly carting it into Jerusalem? Well, who's to say that the Lord was not also upset with David? I think what we see here, remember we talked about intrusion ethics and how sometimes God overtly intrudes into the context of common grace with a visible expression of how he feels about sin. We could cross-reference Ananias and Sapphira in the book of Acts. God may have been, and probably was, upset with David that he had not overseen the proper carting of the ark. I don't think the point really was just Uzzah. But Uzzah's life was forfeited to make a point to the rest of Israel as to what kind of God they were dealing with. Now, God is a good God and a gracious God, and so Uzzah may have been escorted into a far better place than ancient Israel at that point. We needn't fear that somehow he was done a gross injustice and that was unfair to him. The loss of our human life is not necessarily the worst thing that could happen to us. Was there another? Yes, Linda. Right. Yeah. Are we to read verse 13 as implying that the ark was then carried properly? Yes. Verse 13, when those who were carrying the ark of the Lord had taken six steps, he sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. Now, some have interpreted that to mean that every six steps they did that, which would have been a rather slow process. It's not impossible. They did have a lot of time. They didn't watch as much TV back then. You know, life was slower. It's more likely that they took six steps, sort of got into the journey, and then offered sacrifices, maybe sacrifices of thanksgiving and appeal that, you know, may it continue to go well. We've made it six paces, and then carried it on in. The book of Chronicles, across the parallel passage in the book of Chronicles, makes it even clearer that the problem was they were carting the ark, and then they began to carry it. Okay. Any other questions? Yes, sir? Yes. Okay. Right. The question has to do with verse 14, in which it's David is described as wearing a linen ephod and dancing before the Lord with all his might. Yeah, a linen ephod is a typically priestly garment. Samuel is described as wearing a linen ephod when he was in the household of Eli, who was a priest. Interestingly, David does combine as king some priestly functions. He doesn't have a Levitical genealogy, but as king, there was something special about his relationship to God that he did seem to combine some priestly functions. Here he was acting, as it were, in a priestly capacity, dancing before the ark and wearing this linen garment. There's a typological aspect to the way in which that looks toward Christ, who would be both king and priest and prophet. You know, David is described in the New Testament as being a prophet. It says, you know, David was a prophet, and he said. So, in a way, David does typify the coming Messiah, the coming anointed one, who would be a son of David, who would be prophet, priest, and king in a far grander way than David ever was. Yes. Yeah, the following kings did not so much serve in that capacity, but then again, they did not also typically display the measure, the quality of faith that David did. Yeah, we'll have further looks at those if we ever get to the book of Kings as we move on to the second half of chapter 6. Let me say one thing about this episode with Michael. If I were to entitle this, I might entitle this section, "The Price of Being a Fanatic." David was regarded by Michael as a fanatic because of his exuberant behavior. And in fact, when he came back from dancing before the ark, she rather sarcastically says in verse 20, "How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, disrobing in the sight of the slave girls of his servants as any vulgar fellow would." Now, he was down to a priestly garment. In other words, he had divested himself of his royalty in order to humble himself and to celebrate before God. And so it's not quite, you shouldn't think of David as, you know, pardon the expression, a flasher or something. I mean, he hadn't disrobed himself in any inappropriate way, I don't think. But she did not like the fact that his dignity had in some way been impaired. And so she says, how he has distinguished himself, how he has honored himself. The word again is that word kaved, which means to be honored or to be weighty. How you have honored yourself. And David responds, and we don't know whether this was a godly response or not. It sort of depends on the inflection with which you read it. "It was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father or anyone from his house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this, but I will be humiliated in my own eyes." It's probably good to construe that positively. But then he goes on to say, "But by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor. I will be," same word as dignified, "how you have honored yourself." And he says, "You're right. And I will be honored by them." You know, you don't like it. You don't like what you're seeing, because Michal was daughter of Saul. And it's interesting that in verse 20 we have an explicit epithet, you know, Michael, daughter of Saul. Now, we know she's the daughter of Saul. We've been told that over and over again. But those who read biblical narratives have observed that often when an explicit epithet, a description of who this individual is given, even when we already know it, when that's given extra special, it's often to make a point. And I think here it's saying, Michael, daughter of Saul, acting, you know, chip off the old block or chipette off the old block, whatever it is, I don't know how that works. Michael's acting like her father, you know, and has kind of the same sense of values. Yes, in the back. Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah, the comment has to do with what might have prompted Michael to adopt this kind of attitude toward David. Maybe it was her bitter experience of having been taken from David, given to Paltiel, a man who really loved her and who expressed that love for her, and then she was taken back by David, possibly for nothing more than political reasons. We're not sure. But she was taken back, and Paltiel went along behind her weeping. Possibly. It's interesting to reflect on those things. We can't push too far into that because the text really doesn't give us enough evidence to be able to draw conclusions along those lines. It is great stuff, though, if you want to write a historical novel, to think about that, and you can get into some of those. And we're dealing with real people, so real things like that did happen. It's just hard to know for sure. As it is hard to know for sure whether David's response was rightful or wrongful. He ends by saying in verse 23, "And Michael, daughter of Saul, had no children," or the narrator says, "And Michael, daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death." And the narrator leaves us uncertain as to whether this is a judgment of God, you know, who opens and closes the womb, as he had closed Hannah's womb and then opened her womb, or whether this is a judgment of David. After his little comment about, "And by these slave girls you speak of, I will be held in honor, and I'll have nothing further to do with you." We don't know. We don't know. It's hard to assess David's behavior here. We do know that he was acting joyfully before the Lord, should not have been criticized for being humbled and humiliated. That's the right attitude to have. Whether he responded then to his wife in the right way, we're not sure. We're going to need to stop here and take a break because I saw the little flash card back there. So we'll take a break now and come back.